Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have a very special guest. He has written a book on Barbaro, Greatness and Goodness, Barbaro and His Legacy. Now, am I saying that name right? Is it Barbaro?
It's actually Barbaro.
Barbaro, excuse me. I knew I was going to say the name wrong. I apologize. This is Alex Brown. He's written a book on the Barbaro, and it's just out in all your bookstores now, and he's going to join us. Hello.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Now, is it indeed in all the bookstores in the area, or is this more of an online thing that where you can get it?
It's in the Chester County Book and Music Shop, probably two or three other bookstores and sort of saddlery type shops in the area, but mostly, yeah, it's available at Amazon.com.
Oh, okay. So that's where people can get it, just so we know off earth of that. This is one beautiful book. I mean, just looking through the pictures in this book, I mean, I could look at these over and over and over again. Now, who took the pictures in the book? Was it different people or?
Yeah, I mean, one of my goals with the book ultimately was to design a photo essay that retells the entire story. So not only are the 13 chapters, you know, as a result of more than 100 interviews, but the photo essay absolutely retells everything in detail. And there are actually a little over 50 photographers represented in terms of people I worked with to acquire those photographs. I'm one of them, but, you know, some of them are, you know, our most esteemed sort of professional photographers in our industry, and some of them are amateur photographers, and some pictures right out of my iPhone.
When did you first get interested in Barbaro? I mean, when did it first take root that you were going to do this?
Sure. I mean, I the reason why I ended up writing this book, the story actually begins with me running a website for a trainer friend of mine, Tim Woolley, and we were following Barbaro's progress as he prepared for the Preakness Stakes, the second leg of the Triple Crown. We know what happened, unfortunately, in that race, and then, you know, Barbaro lived for a further 8 months at New Bolton Center. They tried to sort of save his life. And, you know, I continued to run this site and sort of kept people updated with the status at New Bolton Center. A large community developed. I still am part of that large community, and it just seemed appropriate at some point to write a book about the entire story.
Right. So it's like it really is a tribute to him.
Correct. It's a tribute to him. I think and I hope it's the most accurate document on his life itself. But then I sort of get a little analytical and explore some issues like, was he truly a great racehorse, and why was he so inspirational? And because the story sort of occurred now, what, 3 or 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I can sort of look at the legacy that Barbaro has left us and sort of where we've gone as a result of Barbaro, which, again, I think is kind of interesting.
Now, he was named after a foxhound, of all things. Well, how did that come to be?
Correct. I mean, he was named after a painting, a lithograph, I should say, of six foxhounds that actually belonged to Roy Jackson's family. The lithograph belonged to them. And, you know, Roy and Gretchen used that lithograph to name actually the full brothers to Barbaro too. So there's Barbaro, Nicanor, Lentinor, and Margano, and named after the four of the six foxhounds in that painting. And to be honest, I think I had a conversation with Mrs. Jackson about this at one point as I put the book together, and she just said, you know, it wasn't, you know, for any other reason than it was becoming harder and harder to find a source of names for horses, and they had this lithograph. The names were I guess they thought they were cool names of foxhounds, so they started using them for their horses.
Now, your book's also dedicated to Dickie and Ralph. Who are Dickie and Ralph? What's the story behind that?
They're two of my closest friends from England. Sadly, Dickie is no longer with us. He was a college friend of mine, and Ralph, and Dickie is probably my biggest inspiration in terms of sort of, you know, my work ethic and what I do from a work standpoint. And Ralph is probably my biggest sort of inspiration in terms of being a horseman. So it's the combination of those two inspirations that ultimately has kind of led me down the path of, you know, on the one hand, academia, but on the other hand, always sticking to the horses.
What is it about Barbaro that so entranced you, that so made you want to write this book? I mean, what was it about him when you obviously have been with Barbaro before he was euthanized, but what was it about Barbaro?
I mean, Barbaro was the quintessential great athlete. You know, whether a human athlete or, in our case here, an equine athlete, he truly was in his own class. And obviously we now, you know, he was an athlete struck down in his prime, and just seeing everybody rallying around him to try to do the best for the horse, I think that in of itself was inspirational. But just as a great athlete, I think he had some sort of characteristics, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, that we aspire for ourselves. I think some of the things that Barbaro demonstrated, we'd be very fortunate to be able to demonstrate some of those characteristics. And, you know, he came around at a time where, you know, not only were we looking for inspirational figures, you know, we were in the economy wasn't too good, we were in a couple of wars and some various other things, mm-hmm. but we're also getting so used to human failings. We have heroes, they let us down. Barbaro was a hero. He never let us down.
Right. Absolutely. Right. Have you always been an animal lover?
I've always, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't call myself an animal rights kind of person, but, yeah, I've always loved dogs and cats. I've always been a horseman. I mean, I feel that if someone gives you the label of a horseman, that's a real badge of honor. But I've always been close to horses.
Now, do you own any horses yourself?
Currently, I don't, but I'm hoping to, in the not-too-distant future. There's a horse that's racing right now up at Woodbine up in Toronto that I'm hoping when he retires, I will get to own him. That's the current plan anyway.
Right. How long did it take you to write this book? I mean, there's so much in this book. I mean, it's amazing what you've put together. I mean, there's different parts to it, and the pictures, like I said, and there's all kinds of people, these surgeons, and I love the picture section where you just go through everybody associated with Barbaro and just show us who they are and what they. But how long did it take you to put all this together? I mean, it had to be a lot of work.
Yeah, I mean, basically what happened was in 2007, I sort of had a plan to write this book. I did some preliminary interviews with the main protagonists of the story, like Dr. Dean Richardson, Michael Matza trainer, Peter Brett, the exercise rider, and a few other people. And then I traveled for 2.5 years, and the point of the travel was to do more research and really understand a lot of issues all around North America regarding horse welfare and horse racing activities and so on and so forth. And during that travel, I ended up writing a couple of chapters of the book as I was doing the research. When I returned from the travel at the end of 2009, I was at a point where it was like, am I actually going to write this book and get it done, or am I going to continue to sort of meander along and you know, maybe get it done at some point? So I quit everything and I stayed in my house. I would ride a few horses in the mornings just to sort of make a little bit of cash, but I spent the entire end of 2009, 2010, up to October, only doing research and actually writing the book. And the two chapters I'd written as I was on the road, I actually trashed and rewrote. One thing that I discovered, if I ever write another book, which I won't, is you should really write the first chapter first.
Right.
So I ended up... But anyway, that whole year... That's all I did, essentially, was work on the book.
Well, every author is different, so it's hard for me to say, yeah, you're right, you should have started for the first chapter, because everybody has their process, and they do it the way they want to do it, and what works best for them. And obviously, that worked best for you.
Right, and you know, the value in the content that I wrote that I ended up not using, and I learned a lot from the process of writing those two chapters that I was able to apply to other parts of the content of the book. So it certainly wasn't a waste of time. But it was kind of interesting. I mean, I had probably 100 pages of material written that absolutely has never seen the light of day.
Right. Now, before Barbara was euthanized, when was the last time you saw Barbara?
The photograph of me with Barbara in the book was from Christmas Day 2006.
Right.
I probably visited with Barbara through early in January 2007. So I would say I probably visited him the last time about three and a half weeks before he unfortunately lost his life.
Could you see that it was going to happen? Or, I mean, did you think that it was going to happen at that point?
At that point, no. I mean, things were really looking good. There was discussions about him leaving, and I talk about a little bit in the book. The plan ultimately was for him to go to Three Chimneys Farm in Kentucky. They, you know, made accommodations for his arrival. They'd done some things. I mean, it really did look good right up until maybe 3 weeks prior to him losing his life. I mean, ultimately, they did fix that broken leg, and hopefully I made that pretty clear in the book. It was the disease of, you know, laminitis that killed him. And laminitis really is a tough issue to deal with. Many times horses look like they're clearing out of the woods, and then, boom, something happens, and they can go downhill very rapidly. So, I mean, 3.5-4 weeks prior, I'd assumed things were going in the right direction. I'm not a vet, though, nor did I, you know, whenever I did help out with Barbara, I wouldn't have visual access to the laminitic foot. I mean, it would be in bandages and stuff, so I wouldn't be able to observe anything.
Right. But it's just, you know, it's sad to think about that. Barbara lived how many years?
He
was born in 2003, right, and then was euthanized in
2003 and euthanized in 2007. So, I mean, in thoroughbred years, we call him a four-year-old. He hadn't actually had his fourth birthday, I guess. He was born in April 29, so he hadn't actually gotten to that birthday. But thoroughbreds would change their age in January, the beginning of each year. In the Northern Hemisphere, anyway. But if you think, you know, for his age, he died very young, but he made a huge impact on a lot of people. Definitely left his mark, and I think he's changed things for the good forever in certain aspects to do with how we deal with horses and the issue of laminitis and so forth, which I think is phenomenal.
Had he not had the laminitis, how long could a horse like that be expected to live? I mean, ultimately, without any problems coming along.
Yeah, I mean, he could have been a breeding sire. He could have lived and bred horses till his mid-20s and then retired and lived out his life till late 20s.
Wow.
Or whatever. I mean, a horse can live for a good amount of time.
Right. So he was definitely cut short. I mean, there's definitely a lot that didn't happen.
Yeah, we lost a lot by losing Barbara. And if anyone actually tells you, and again, this is something I address in the book from a quote from Vic Stauffer, who was one of the race callers who called his race. If anyone ever says that, you know, Barbara losing his life was a good thing, I mean, that's just bullshit. I mean, he was a great horse, and we wanted to see a great racehorse, and we wanted to see a great racehorse that ultimately became a great stallion, that ultimately became a great retired stallion. That's ultimately what we all wish to see. I mean, sadly, that didn't happen. And because of what happened to Barbara, lots of other horses and issues are going to be better off for it. But losing Barbara was good for nothing. I mean, it was terrible.
Right. Now, I'm looking at this number 7 with this picture of Barbara as a foal, and it's one of these pictures I keep going back to and keep looking at again. It's such a beautiful horse. Now, in this picture, how much does Barbara weigh, and what was the most he ever weighed?
I wouldn't know. That was a picture taken when he was 6 weeks old. I wouldn't have a clue what a foal weighs, to be honest. So I'm not going to speculate. But he was a pretty decent-sized foal by all accounts, and in the picture he looks like a decent size. But that picture is one of the very few foal pictures of Barbara, because obviously at that point he's not famous and not lots of people are taking pictures.
Right.
And if you notice on that picture, there's identification written on the left where it says Dynaforma.
Right.
I think maybe 03, Laville Rouge. So it's kind of like an ID photograph. But what it is a photograph that we took, or the photographer Ray Phelan took, of a photograph that the Jacksons have in their collection. Now, I think somewhere in the book I document his weight during his time at New Bolton Center, somewhere around 1,100 and some pounds.
Wow.
So he was he was a good sized horse. And in fact, he grew during his time at New Bolton Center. Like, he grew taller a little bit. So he was definitely a bigger than your average thoroughbred.
Now, I know you didn't ride Barbaro in a race, but did you ever just ride Barbaro before he became famous?
No.
Never?
No.
Did you want to?
I never worked for Michael Matz. So
okay.
In order for me to have ridden Barbaro, I'd have to have worked for Michael Matz. Peter Brett, who I talk about and interviewed quite a lot for the book, he was Barbaro's main exercise rider. He rode all of Barbaro's work, or most of it. There were other people that rode Barbaro, and I go into that a little bit in the book, but mostly, it was Peter Brett. Now, would I have wanted to ride Barbaro? Are you kidding me? That would have just been an incredible experience. Yes, absolutely. And I think as an exercise rider, which is a job I've had for a number of years, we always sort of look for the opportunity to get on the good horse and the great horse or the big horse or whatever. And yeah, I mean, I wouldn't do what I did if I didn't want to get on a horse like Barbaro. It would have been fantastic. I mean, the feelings a horse like that would give you as you're galloping would be something you can't really describe to someone that doesn't ride horses.
Right. Now,
probably better. I just have to add, it's probably better than good sex. But what are you going to say?
Well, all right. I didn't expect that, but that's okay. I'm wondering how did they know that Barbaro could win these races? I mean, what was it about Barbaro that made them think, well, this is a great horse that we can ride? And
right.
And
yeah, I mean, yeah. So Michael Matz's trainer obviously knows horses. Peter Brett, Michael Matz has a long history with horses from the equestrian world, so he knew he knows what a good horse is. Peter Brett, the exercise rider and assistant trainer, has a very long history. He was a champion jockey in Dubai. He knows horses. He's from England. Of course, being from England means he knows horses, right? Because we all know horses. So anyway, the point being, they know their horses. They're training a lot of horses. They'll be working them in pairs and so forth. And, you know, every time Barbaro works, he just works a lot better than anything else that's working with him. So they knew, going into his very first race, that they had a really nice horse on their hands. Now, obviously, you don't know how nice a horse is until they're put under a bit of pressure. So I'm not going to tell you right from the very beginning they absolutely knew they had a Derby-winning horse, and not only a Derby-winning horse, but a sensational Derby-winning horse. But they always knew he was a good horse right from the very beginning.
Now, this picture, number 19, the second one at the Laurel Futurity, what a beautiful picture this is. Did you have any trouble getting these pictures in the book? I mean, was anybody not willing to let you use their pictures, or did you?
I would say that picture that you cite, that's by Lydia Williams, is probably, if not my favorite photograph in the book, one of my favorites. And you know, there's probably three or four that I would put in that category, actually, so it's one of my favorites. It's a stunning photograph, and I believe that photograph is in of itself is worth the price of the book for people that love horses. I mean, it's stunning. That's his second race. He just wins it with ease, and almost to the eye, you know, to the eye that really knows what they're looking at, almost looks like Barbaro just, you don't know what he's doing. He's just that much better than everybody else, and it's just a fun thing that he does. Now, you know, working with photographers like Lydia Williams, like Barbara Livingston, and I could name four or five others that I worked with in the book of equally high caliber, you know, Matt Woolley and whatever, they were brilliant to work with. They absolutely supported this project. I think people just have a very strong affinity for the horse and wanted to help me put this document together as a tribute to the horse and all the people that were connected with the horse. Now, was it always easy to work with everybody? No, and I won't name any names, but there was definitely one or two people that were complete pain in the ass to work with. But, you know, they probably thought I was a whatever too, right? So, it all worked in the end. I got absolutely incredible support. And the key to that support was the support from the Jacksons, Barbara's owners. If they hadn't supported this project, I wouldn't have been able to interview 100 and some people, nor get photographs from 50 plus people.
Well, thanks to them. What a wonderful thing. Now, what kind of a jockey do you have to be to ride Barbara? I mean, what do they look for when they look for a good jockey? I mean, how do you determine who gets to ride? And
there are two sort of types of people there. Firstly, the guy that rides them in the mornings. So the jockey that rides them in the afternoons is, in many cases, and certainly in Barbara's case, a different guy than and guys gender neutral, can be female or male, different person who gets on them in the morning. In Michael Matz's case, yeah, they've got a good horse in the barn. Peter Brett's going to ride him because that's his number one guy and his go-to guy, and he's going to help develop the horse and educate him and get him ready for his races, and that's what you look for in an exercise ride, and that's sort of job that I do, is you're trying to not only sort of get the horse fit, but you're also schooling them and giving them some clue as to what they're supposed to be doing. And then in terms of a jockey in the afternoon, I mentioned this a little bit in the book, actually. Michael Matz asked Peter Brett if he would ride him in the afternoon in his first race, and Peter declined the offer. I think Peter probably regrets that to this day.
Why did he decline?
He used to be a champion jockey, but he, you know, by going back and riding a race, you've got to commit a lot of time and effort.
Right, okay.
To get fit to do that, right? So he decided not to, and Jose Caraballo was Michael Matz, who's one of his main, if not his main, rider at that point in the Mid-Atlantic area, so it was natural that he would get the job. When Barbara then moved down to Florida for the winter, a decision, I guess, at that point was made. All the leading jocks around the country wanted to get on the horse, and he was moving to a different racing circuit, and Edgar Prado at the time was, you know, probably, well, ultimately he was the leading jockey of that year. He wanted to get on the horse, so leading jockey, leading horse, that's how that worked.
But does it ever happen where a jockey, a really great jockey, doesn't gel with a horse? I mean, that something happens and they just can't ride the horse, the horse reacts badly to them? Does that ever happen?
I wouldn't say it never happens. It rarely happens, though. You know, typically, very good jockeys are very good jockeys for very good reasons. But you will say that a certain type of jockey suits a certain type of horse sometimes. You know, maybe a jockey that gets a little aggressive might be good on a colt and not so good on a smaller filly and such. So that may be true, but mostly your top jock gets on the top horse, and that's a good combination. And that was, you know, what happened with Barbara. Edgar Prado and Barbara were a great combination.
Now, are there some horses that race too much, and is that why they get injured? I mean, does that happen? I mean, Barbara didn't race more than he should have, did he?
Right. No, Barbara only raced, what, six times?
Six times, yeah. But does it happen sometimes?
Figure that was the cause of the problem. It does happen. And, you know, I'm a huge racing fan, but I'll be the first to say that our business and our industry needs to, you know, change some things to make the sport better. And we're always challenged with doing that. Some people race the horse too often. Some people don't race them often enough. And that can also have an adverse effect. So, you there's always a little bit of a fine line.
So we don't know exactly why he got laminitis then?
Well, we know why he got laminitis. And the reason why he got laminitis, or at least the most probable reason, because there are other potential reasons, but the most probable reason was he was getting weight off his broken leg and put additional weight on the foot that ultimately got the first foot to get laminitis. And that was a problem. Now, it wasn't a surprise that this was a potential issue down the road for Barbara. And obviously Dean Richardson and his staff did everything that they possibly could to avoid the onset of laminitis. But nevertheless, it was always going to be a danger, and it happened.
Now, were you...
Once it happened, it just added a whole set of problems to what was already a pretty tricky issue.
Now, were you at the Kentucky Derby, and did you really feel that Barbara was going to win?
We had a big party at Fair Hill with all the Fair Hill people, Fair Hill being where Michael Matz trains and where Barbara was trained as a two-year-old and ultimately leading up to the Preakness Stakes too. So we had a big party at Fair Hill, and Barbara went off at 6-1. I don't bet ordinarily, but at 6-1, that was just giving money away. So yeah, I had $80 to win on. It was. I just thought, you know, he was undefeated. Everything was just too easy for him. His training up to the Derby had been sensational. His work prior to the Derby was sensational. So, you know. I just thought he would win the race. I know a lot of other people did, and we all made quite a lot of money that day.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm looking at this number 22, picture number 22, and the horse is racing in the mud. You never quite see that in any movies or anything, the mud, no. All the mud that is really...
I mean, Barbaro, that was his first race on the dirt. So he won three races on the turf very easily. He won that race in the mud, the Holy Bull Stakes. He then won the Florida Derby on a fast dirt surface, and then obviously the sensation, the Kentucky Derby on a fast dirt surface. He truly proved what great horses can truly do, and that's run on any kind of surface and win. Good horses tend to favor one surface over another. So you might have a good turf horse that doesn't run well on the dirt, or vice versa. But he was sensational on every surface.
Right. Now, what's with the tape on the legs? I mean, is that just a precautionary thing?
Yeah, we do that with most horses. Races, we put bandages on them. Some of it's just to protect their legs if they strike something or a leg strikes into them or something, which is rare, but it happens. So, you know, most races you'll see horses have, they're kind of like elastoplast-type bandages on them.
Right. Now I'm looking at this Chad Harmon picture. This is another great one. This is actually taken at the Kentucky Derby. How many people normally show up for the Kentucky Derby? And are we talking hundreds of thousands or how many?
Yeah. I mean, that's the one day our sport is showcased to the nation. So at the track, there's, I don't know if there's 150,000 or 120,000, I forget, but I did put the number in the book somewhere.
Right. Now,
it's a massive number of people.
Right.
But obviously it's also the time when TV's watching us and radio and so on and so forth. So you win the Kentucky Derby, everybody knows who you are, even if you're not a spectacular winner. But when you're spectacular like Barbara, you get a lot of people excited.
Now, it's coming up next month. What's the date next month, the Kentucky Derby?
It's always on the first Saturday in May.
Always first Saturday.
It's at May 7th.
Yeah. May 7th, yeah. That's it. Do you look forward to that every year?
You know, obviously, yeah, you get a little excited about it. For me, particularly this year, I'm very excited because the timing of my book launch is sort of centered around sort of trying to promote the book up and to and through the Triple Crown, of which the Derby is the first leg. So I'm hoping to spend a lot of time over the course of the next month in Kentucky doing things with my book. But yeah, I think we all get excited for this time of year.
Right. Now, I haven't asked where you were born in England?
Yes.
Where in England?
Cheshire, which is a county just south of Manchester.
Now, is that a big horse-racing town?
England, Ireland, Scotland, we're all big into the horses. We got horse racing up and down the country. We're not really a big training center as such, like Newmarket or Lambourne, other parts of England, but there'll be horse trainers throughout Cheshire. We've got a couple of good racetracks like Haydock Park. It's all horse country, yeah.
When did you ride your first horse? How old were you?
Probably about the same age as when I first started to walk. I've been very fortunate. I've been able to ride horses all my life.
That sounds great. Now, I'm just looking through the pictures here. There's so many wonderful pictures. I mean, here's one of, this is the day after the Kentucky Derby win. And, just a beautiful horse. I mean,
The point of the pictures the day after the Kentucky Derby is to show that, he just ran what is considered, at that point, the most grueling race a horse can run. It's a mile and a quarter, the first time they've ever run that far. And Barbara just looked spectacular the next day. And let me tell you, not all Kentucky Derby runners look spectacular the day after they've run in the Kentucky Derby.
Right, but he certainly did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, nothing fazed him. It was an easy race, an easy win.
I love the little picture of the little kid with feeding the horse, too. I mean, he was feeding Barbara. Yeah. And
that was cool. And I'll tell you exactly the reason why I wanted to use that photograph. Because if you look at the caption of that photograph, I talk about Barbaro's nickname, which was Bobby. Now, I couldn't work that into the main narrative to talk about, Barbaro's stable name and so on and so forth. And, I want this book to be the definitive work on the horse and everything there is to know about him, which would also include what was his pet name, his stable name. The reason why he was called Bobby was because Peter Brett's son, Nicholas, who was young at the time, couldn't pronounce the name Barbaro at the time. So then they nicknamed him Bobby. And then, obviously, I add in another little anecdote for sort of racing aficionados. That was also the stable barn name for the horse Farlap, who was another great racehorse in the past.
Now, how long does it take to prepare for a race like the Kentucky Derby? And what has to be done to prepare a horse for the Kentucky Derby?
Well, I mean, it's every breeder's and owner's dream in thoroughbred horse racing to win that race. So when that foal is born, they're looking at it and saying, can we win the Kentucky Derby? So you could almost say from those steps, people are preparing a horse to do that. Now, to qualify to run in the Kentucky Derby, a horse has to win a certain amount of what they call graded stakes earnings. So they have to have performed in the top end of our horse racing in what we call graded stakes, earn some money from those races, and the horses that earn the most money qualify. And there's only 20 horses that can run in the Derby. In Barbaro's case, he won the Florida Derby, the Holy Bull Stakes, and the Tropical Park Derby were all graded stakes. So earnings from each of those races qualified Barbaro for the Kentucky Derby. It takes a lot of preparing, meticulous planning, and a little bit of luck. And if you don't want a little bit of luck, you're not going to get anywhere.
Now, there are a lot of vets that were associated with Barbaro. How many vets did he have? I mean, I keep seeing different vets in the book. But how many actually worked on Barbaro?
Well, there are two principal vets. Dr. Kathy Anderson was his vet whilst he was a racehorse at Fairhill. When Michael Match trained him. So, I mean, every trainer will work with a vet to do sort of therapeutic work, making sure the horse is doing good and various other things. By all accounts, Barbaro was always doing good, so very little work was done. Now, when he had surgery, you have a whole different set of vets. So Dr. Dean Richardson led that team at New Bolton Center. But Dr. Dean Richardson will be the first to tell you that he was part of a big team of people helping Barbara through that 8 months. So there are a variety of deaths that also involve, and there's a photograph in there, in the book, just a quick photo off my iPhone of Dr. Liberty Getman. She was one of the other New Bolton Center vets. But, you know, I've listed a bunch of others, and, you know, I try to give due credit to whoever worked with this horse, because I think everybody that did work with him should be acknowledged, right? I mean, he was a, in my mind, one of the most significant cultural icons in the first part of the 21st century, so anyone that had something to do with that is good in my book.
Right, I can only imagine the cards and letters that Barbara must have gotten while he was suffering.
Yeah.
I mean, there must have been thousands and thousands.
I think it was, it was an extraordinary outpouring. And, you know, I produced a little bit of that in the book. He captured the imagination of a lot of people. But I also think, you know, the way that Barbara's owners responded to that outpouring sort of helped nurture that movement, because they were very gracious. They acknowledged a lot of the outpouring, wrote personal letters themselves to thank people. I mean, I think that's a part of our past that we need to do a lot more of, act or behave in that fashion.
I'm looking at this picture of Peiko. Now, is Peiko the different colored horse, not the brown one, the one on the right?
Right, yeah.
What color is that, anyway? I mean, what color?
He would be a pony. I'm not actually looking at the pictures as you are, but what number is it? I can see.
Number 56.
Number 56?
And Barbara?
So that's Paco. So he would be, Palomino.
Palomino.
That's what I might call it in England, but they might have a different word over here that I haven't.
This is a very unusual looking horse. I liked it. I liked the one on there.
Yeah, but he's not a thoroughbred. And he's there, and, you know, we use horses to help the thoroughbreds warm up before the races, and that's what Paco's there to do.
Would you ride every day if you could? Or do you ride every day?
I used to. I don't ride now because all I'm doing right now is trying to sell this book.
Right.
being the publisher and the salesman, I don't have a big publishing company supporting the book. So, you know, like getting the book in the Chester County bookshop is very important to me. But, I mean, I have to do that work myself. So wherever the book is available, you know, I have to help make that happen.
It must be a lot of work.
It's a lot of work right now. I'm in Houston, Texas, talking to you. So I'm down here doing some work, and I'm traveling around with the book.
It must be immensely rewarding to look at this and know that you've put something together so wonderful that people are really going to enjoy and love and already have. I mean, they're ordering quite a number of copies of it. But that must be extremely rewarding to know that.
I'm very excited with the feedback the book's been getting. I mean, I'm flattered and a little bit humbled by it all. What I will say is, you know, I finished producing this book, let's say in November. I think by that point, the designer and the project manager were completely fed up with me, in a good way. But, you know, I was tweaking this, tweaking that, suggesting this, and I'm a complete hands-on kind of dude when it comes to a project like this.
A little bit of a perfectionist?
I mean, I had a very strong vision for what I wanted to do. And
you know what you wanted.
I'd wake up, and I'd wake up in the middle of the night and say, you know what, if we did it this way, it'd probably be a little bit better. So I kept working and working until the very end. And then I'll tell you, so that's the beginning of November. We were working like that. And then once I put it, we put it to bed and it went to print and so forth. And even now, 3, 4, 5 months later, there's not one thing I would change.
That's great. So you got everything you wanted.
This is our best effort.
And
I say our best effort because I did work with some really cool people. The designer, Gwyn Snyder, was just phenomenal. The project manager, Bethany Brown. Yeah, I mean, the book wouldn't be what it is without those two people.
Right.
And then even in the acknowledgements, you see other people, Kim Gatto, Carolyn Carlson, put in hundreds of hours for nothing just to help produce this book.
That's just great.
So, yeah, I mean, it's terrific. I sort of sat there just having ideas about it and try to write some stuff. But I'm extremely proud of the book. It's gotten a couple of reviews now. I'm absolutely thrilled with those. I'm excited. But, you know, I had the opportunity to write about something I was very passionate about. And, you know, I just hope I've done the subject matter justice.
Now, the Preakness, this was the 131st Preakness. So what was the first indication that something was wrong with Barbaro? I mean, what was it about? What happened that indicated something was wrong? Or couldn't you tell at first?
Well, no, you can tell, because as soon as something's wrong, they've got to pull the horse off. So it was very evident very quickly that this was an absolute catastrophe. But, you know, I would urge people to read the Preakness chapter. I know it's probably the one chapter in the book that will be least read. Lots of people still struggle to revisit that moment.
Why is that? Just because of what happened?
Because they get so emotional, they know what happened, they just don't want to deal, not that they don't want to deal with it, but I mean, you know, it's just still a very tough moment for a lot of people that ended up loving this horse.
Right.
But, you know, I interviewed a lot of people and that were involved in what happened at the Preakness in terms of sort of reacting to the situation, making sure Barbara had every chance to survive and getting into New Bolton Center. And, you know, it's a really good example of a lot of people getting together, doing exactly the right thing for the single sole purpose of helping to save a horse's life.
Right.
And, you know, you see how we react to this kind of catastrophe, I think is really quite interesting, sort of, it makes you feel proud of who we are as people. There are lots of instances these days that makes you feel quite the opposite in terms of human nature, but not that day. Everybody really did everything they could to get the right result.
Now, what exactly is an outrider? There's a picture of you with an outrider, Sharon Greenberg. What is an outrider? I'm not familiar with that term.
They'll have two or three people at the races that are independent of everything that's going on. They're kind of just watching things that go on. And if there's a problem, if there's a loose horse, of which, you know, unfortunately there often is, the outrider's there to sort of help catch the horse or help make sure things happen. So Sharon, you know, she helped, you know, when Barbara was stricken and waiting for help. She was there as the outrider, making sure that everybody in the race was alerted to what was going on. They could see there was a problem or whatever. And the horse, her horse, was that, you know, his presence helped, you know, keep Barbaro calm. You know, a horse likes to be with another horse. So his presence, too, was very important. You know, DJ, he had a job to do, too.
Now, I'm looking at picture number 72. This is Barbaro, excuse me, I keep saying that name wrong. Right hind leg.
Right.
It's just it's just interesting to look, and we get to look inside the leg and see what all was in there. I mean, it just blows your mind to look at that.
What, the X-ray?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you see all the screws and the hardware that they applied to that leg.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was a very tricky piece of surgery. It wasn't impossible that they were going to save his life, but it was a very complicated surgery.
Now, how long did that take? How long did that surgery take?
I think it, if my memory serves, and again, I'm sure the timeline is in the book, but
right.
The surgery itself was probably 3, 4, or 5 hours, but then you have a recovery period, you know, because the horse is going to be anaesthetized. Under anesthetic for the surgery, then they've got to recover to come out of the surgery, and they'll do that actually in a recovery pool to avoid any further problems with the leg. But yeah, I mean, it was complicated, not impossible. It didn't work out in the end, we know that, but certainly the effort was absolutely worthwhile.
Now, this one of you and Barbaro, number 80, is really great, too. I mean, that was taken on Thursday, December 28th. Might that have been the last time you saw Barbaro?
No, I saw him after that. But, I mean, you look at his eye in that picture. You know, he looked good. The horse looked good. And that was a month, prior to him losing his wife. But, you know, like I say, up until the very end, they really did think they were going to save his life. And certainly at that point, that was the general consensus.
Must have had a lot of people praying for Barbera. There's a lot of signs to say pray for Barbera. And, you know. And where is the, there is a memorial to this day?
Yeah.
Where?
And I write about this in the book, in the final chapter. He's memorialized at Churchill Downs. He's the only horse buried at Churchill Downs, which is the home of the Kentucky Derby. The memorial itself is absolutely spectacular. Certainly one of the most spectacular of horse memorials. And, you know, in 100 years' time, when people go to the Kentucky Derby, assuming we still have a Kentucky Derby and it's still at Churchill Downs, you have to wonder which horses of our generation they're going to remember, and they're going to walk right into Barbara, so it's going to be hard for them to forget.
Right. I'm looking at picture number 85, that tribute to Barbara, and it's just amazing. With the roses, I guess the roses at the top. And these pictures are just worth a thousand words, like they say. They truly are. There's just so many beautiful ones in here, though.
Yeah. No, I mean, like I say, I was very fortunate to work with a lot of really cool people that gave me access to their photographs.
Did you become friends with a lot of them? Did you talk to this day?
Sure. I mean, I've met people all along the way involved in the Barbara Project one way or another, and I'm staying in Houston, as I mentioned earlier, tonight with someone I met through the whole Barbara Project.
Right.
In fact, a lot of my travel, and I'm traveling over the, two or three months selling the book, is basically being supported by people I've met through Barbara because I'm staying with them.
Right.
And that obviously cuts down on my expenses, which is very necessary.
Absolutely. Here's a florist in Kennett Square, which is only about half an hour from where I am right now.
Yeah.
It's so
yeah.
cool to see things in your area, in my area.
Yeah. And they were very, very important connection between, people that wanted to, express good wishes to Barbara and his connections and Barbara and his connections, because they could deliver flowers, they could deliver gifts, whatever it might have been, and a lot of that was done.
I'm certainly in awe of the effort you put into this. I mean, it's just, it's a labor of love, and look what it netted. It's just amazing.
Well, I appreciate that. This is my best piece of work.
So, why is it you won't write another book? I'm curious. Is it just too much work and it takes too much out of you, or?
I would tell you, I mean, you know much more about the sort of the book industry and more familiar with it than I.
Right.
I'm an exercise writer. I can write a little bit, but I'm not an author. Like, I was in a unique situation, and I was able to put this together. But, I put this akin to, running a marathon, which I did, without being properly trained, which I did. And you only do that once, too, because it's like, that's agony. Now, this wasn't agony because I was very passionate about the subject matter, but there's no way I'd be in a similar situation writing a book about something I was so familiar with. But in this instance, I was in that spot to write this book.
So it's just like a one in a million thing. I mean, you don't think a chance like this will come along again?
No, not at all. And we'll see. But I'm convinced I won't be writing another book. I have no clue what I'll be doing this time next year, but I'm convinced of that.
Right. It's amazing. I've never heard an author say that before. Usually they can't, they tell you they're writing another book and they're working on it, even as they're talking about the one they're promoting when it's out.
Right.
But I mean, it's amazing to hear a writer say, I won't be doing any more books. I'm done.
Yeah. No, I'm a one-shot deal, but I gave it my best effort, and this is my best effort, and it's certainly the most significant piece of work that I've done in any sphere. And I've worked at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, did some stuff up there, which was kind of cool, and I worked at the University of Delaware, and did some stuff there, which was kind of cool, but this is absolutely the most significant piece of work that I've done.
Right, and look what's come of it, something we can all enjoy.
I hope so.
Yeah, I know so.
If not, I've got 4,000 books in my house I've got to get rid of.
Right, 4,000, wow.
Yeah. So that's why I'm driving around trying to get the word out because, you know, as someone that's doing it all myself, I got to promote it and, you know, get product out there.
Right. Well, it seems whatever you're doing,
that's challenging of itself.
Yeah, whatever you're doing, it seems to be working because people are very much enjoying this book. So, and I hope they will enjoy it for years to come.
Well, I keep my fingers crossed.
Right.
But it's like anything. You can have a good book, and you don't connect with your market. There's probably thousands of very, very brilliant books out there that never really took off. So, I'm very conscious of that being a I used to teach marketing right at the University of Delaware, so I'm very conscious of that piece of it. So that's why over the course of the next 2 or 3 months, I'm doing everything and anything that I can to try to promote the book.
Exactly. Now, you have a site. Do you have a site where people can buy the books, too?
Yeah, well, it's just my own website, alexbrownracing.com. But, you know, you can't buy it directly from there, but from there, you know, there'll be a means to buy the book from Amazon. I also have a list of all the retailers that carry the book. I have my address. If you want to mail me a check, I'll send you the book. I mean,
right.
I just use that site to tell people, you know, how to go about getting the book. And just sort of, you know, if you other links about the book, you know, whether it's press releases.
Now, is it only available in the United States right now, or is it available in other countries, too?
It's available through Amazon.com anywhere
okay.
other than, oddly, Canada, and I really haven't figured out why that might be. But someone outside of the country, they still need to use Amazon.com, but they will ship to the UK
okay.
and some other parts. And there's interest there for the book, simply because I'm from the UK. I've a couple of friends that have bought the book, which is great, and, you know, some other parts of the world. I'm a little frustrated about Canada because I actually lived up there for a while and have some really good friends up there that are really keen to get the book. So I'm still trying to figure that out a little bit more.
Right.
But there is I do have it in a retail store on the back, on at the track at Woodbine, so that's good. But yeah, I mean, it's a challenge to get it out there. It's not in all the Barnes & Nobles or Borders, which obviously would mean it's available everywhere. But that's the price you pay for publishing it yourself. There's some real benefits to doing that too, I think.
Right. Well, the book again is called Greatness and Goodness, Barbera and His Legacy by Alex Brown. He's talked with us for the whole, almost an hour here. It's been incredible to talk to you, and this is an incredible book. Thank you so much.
Well, I truly appreciate the opportunity to talk about something I'm really passionate about.
Thanks, and we're happy that you're able to do it.
And very cool.
This has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.